There is no avoiding atonement. A power far greater than us has said this.
It is true, said Sekhardin. The prophecies have come to us, spoken to the true voices over the generations. Humankind is doomed, but with their doom will come a new flowering for pristine environments in all parts of what is now the hegemony.
Trained in Jesuit logic, devoted to the evolutionary theology of Teilhard de Chardin, Father Paul Duret was nonetheless tempted to say, "But who the hell cares if the flowers bloom if no one is around to see them, to smell them?" Instead, he said, "Have you considered that these prophecies were not divine revelations, but merely manipulations from some secular power?" The Templar sat back as if slapped, but the bishop leaned forward and curled two Lusian fists which could have crushed Duret's skull with a single blow.
"Heresy! Whoever dares deny the truth of the revelations must die!"
"What power could do this?" managed the true voice of the World Tree. "What power other than the Muir's absolute could enter our minds and hearts?"
Duret gestured toward the sky.
"Every world in the web has been joined through the Technocore's datasphere for generations. Most people of influence carry comlog extension implants for ease of accessing. Do you not, Emhardin?"
The Templar said nothing, but Duret saw the small twitch of fingers, as if the man were going to pat his chest and upper arm where the micro-implants had lain for decades.
"The Technocore has created a transcendent intelligence," continued Duret. "It taps incredible amounts of energy, is able to move backward and forward in time, and is not motivated by human concerns. One of the goals of a sizable percentage of the core personalities was to eliminate humankind. Indeed, the big mistake of the Kiev team may have been deliberately executed by the AIs involved in that experiment. What you hear as prophecies may be the voice of this Deus Ex Machina whispering through the datasphere. The Shrike may be here not to make humankind atone for its sins, but merely to slaughter human men, women, and children for this machine personality's own goals."
The bishop's heavy face was red as his robe. His fists pummeled the table, and he struggled to his feet. The Templar laid a hand on the bishop's arm and restrained him, somehow pulled him back to his seat.
"Where have you heard this idea?" Sekhardin asked Duret.
"From those on the pilgrimage who have access to the core, and from others."
The bishop shook a fist in Duret's direction.
"But you yourself have been touched by the Avatar, not once but twice. He has granted you a form of immortality so you can see what he has in store for the chosen people, those who prepare atonement before the final days are upon us."
"The Shrike gave me pain," said Duret. "Pain and suffering beyond imagination. I have met the thing twice, and I know in my heart that it is neither divine nor diabolical, but merely some organic machine from a terrible future."
"Bah!"
The bishop made a dismissive gesture, folded his arms, and stared out over the low balcony at nothing. The Templar appeared shaken. After a moment, he raised his head and said softly,
"You had a question for me?"
Duret took a breath.
"I did. And sad news, I'm afraid. True voice of the tree, Hetmastine is dead."
"We know," said the Templar.
Duret was surprised. He could not imagine how they could receive that information. But it did not matter now.
"What I need to know is why did he go on the pilgrimage? What was the mission that he did not live to see completed? Each of us told our story. Hetmastine did not. Yet somehow I feel that his fate held the key to many mysteries."
The bishop looked back at Duret and sneered.
"We need tell you nothing, priest of a dead religion."
Sekhardin sat silent a long moment before responding.
"Hetmastine volunteered to be the one to carry the word of the Muir to Hyperion. The prophecy has lain in the roots of our belief for centuries that when the troubled times came, a true voice of the tree would be called upon to take a tree ship to the holy world
to see it destroyed there, and then to have it reborn carrying the message of atonement and the Muir.
So Hetmestine knew that the tree Yggdrasil would be destroyed in orbit?
Yes, it was foretold.
And he and the single energy binder Erg from the ship were to fly a new tree ship?
Yes, said the Templar almost inaudibly. A tree of atonement, which the Avatar would provide.
Doré sat back, nodded.
A tree of atonement, the thorn tree. Hetmestine was psychically injured when the Yggdrasil was destroyed. Then he was taken to the Valley of the Time Tombs and shown the Shrike's thorn tree. But he was not ready or able to do it. The thorn tree is a structure of death, of suffering, of pain. Hetmestine was not prepared to captain it. Or perhaps he refused. In any case, he fled and died. I thought as much. But I had no idea what fate the Shrike had offered him.
What are you talking about? Snapped the bishop. The Tree of Atonement is described in the prophecies. It will accompany the Avatar in his final harvest. Mastine would have been prepared and honored to captain it through space and time.
Paul Duray shook his head.
We have answered your question? Asked M. Hardine.
Yes.
Then you must answer ours, said the bishop. What has happened to the mother?
What mother?
The mother of our salvation, the bride of atonement, the one you called Braun Lamia.
Duré thought back, trying to remember the consul's taped summaries of the tales the pilgrims had told on the way to Hyperion. Braun had been pregnant with the first Keet Sybrid's child. The Shrike Temple on Lucis had saved her from the mob, included her in the pilgrimage. She had said something in her story about the Shrike cultists treating her with reverence. Doré tried to fit all this into the confused mosaic of what he had already learned. He could not. He was too tired. And, he thought, too stupid after this so-called resurrection. He was not and never would be the intellectual Paul Doré once had been.
Braun was unconscious, he said. Evidently taken by the Shrike and attached to some thing, some cable. Her mental state was the equivalent of brain death, but the fetus was alive and healthy.
And the persona she carried?
Asked the bishop, his voice tense. Duré remembered what Severn had told him about the death of that persona in the Megasphere. Evidently these two did not know about the second Keats persona, the Severn personality that at this moment was warning Gladstone about the dangers of the core proposal. Duré shook his head. He was very tired.
I don't know about the persona she carried in the Shrone Loop, he said. The cable, the thing the Shrike attached to her, seemed to plug into the neural socket like a cortical shunt.
The bishop nodded, evidently satisfied.
The prophecies proceed apace. You have served your purpose as messenger, Duré. I must leave now.
The big man stood, nodded toward the true voice of the World Tree, and swept across the platform and down the stairs toward the elevator and Terminex. Doré sat across from the Templar in silence for several minutes. The sound of leaves blowing and the gentle rocking of the treetop platform was marvelously lulling, inviting the Jesuit to doze off. Above them, the sky was fading through delicate saffron shades as the world of God's Grove turned into twilight.
Your statement about a deus ex machina misleading us for generations through false prophecies was a terrible heresy, the Templar said at last.
Yes, but terrible heresies have proven to be grim truths many times before, in the longer history of my church, Sekhardine.
If you were a Templar, I could have you put to death, the hooded figure said softly.
Duré sighed. At his age, in his situation, and as tired as he was, the thought of death created no fear in his heart. He stood and bowed slightly.
I need to go, Sekhardine. I apologize if anything I said offended you. It is a confused and confusing time.
The best lack all conviction, he thought, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Duré turned and walked to the edge of the platform and stopped. The staircase was gone. 30 vertical meters and 15 horizontal meters of air separated him from the next lower platform where the elevator waited. The World Tree dropped away a kilometer or more into leafy depths beneath him. Duré and the true voice of that tree were isolated here on the highest platform. Duré walked to a nearby railing, raised his suddenly sweaty face to the evening breeze, and noticed the first of the stars emerging from the ultramarine sky.
"What's going on, Sekhardine?"
The robed and cowled figure at the table was wrapped in darkness. "In 18 minutes, Standard, the world of Heaven's Gate will fall to the ousters. Our prophecies say that it will be destroyed. Certainly its Farcaster will, and its Fatline transmitters. And to all intents and purposes that world will have ceased to exist. Precisely 1 standard hour later, the skies of God's Grove will be alight from the fusion fires of ouster warships. Our prophecies say that all of the Brotherhood who remain, and anyone else, although all Hegemony's citizens have long since been evacuated by Farcaster, will perish." Duré walked slowly back to the table.
"It's imperative that I cast to Tau Ceti Center," he said. "Severn, someone is waiting for me. I have to speak to CEO Gladstone."
"No," said true voice of the World Tree, Sekhardine. "We will wait. We will see if the prophecies are correct." The Jesuit clenched his fists in frustration, fighting the surge of violent emotion that made him want to strike the roped figure. Duré closed his eyes and said 2 Hail Marys. It didn't help.
"Please," he said, "the prophecies will be confirmed or denied, whether I am here or not, and then it will be too late. The 4 torch ships will blow the singularity sphere, and the Farcasters will be gone. We'll be cut off from the web for years. Billions of lives may depend upon my immediate return to Tau Ceti Center."
The Templar folded his arms so that his long-fingered hands disappeared in the folds of his robe. "We will wait," he said. "All things predicted will come to pass. In minutes, the Lord of Pain will be loosed on those in the web. I do not believe in the bishop's faith that those who have sought atonement will be spared. We are better off here, Father Duré, where the end will be swift and painless." Duré searched his tired mind for something decisive to say, to do. Nothing occurred to him. He sat at the table and stared at the cowled and silent figure across from him. Above them the stars emerged in their fiery multitudes. The world forest of God's Grove rustled a final time to the evening breeze, and seemed to hold its breath in anticipation. Paul Duré closed his eyes and prayed.
"37. We walk all day, Hunt and I, and toward evening we find an inn with food set out for us. A fowl, rice pudding, cauliflower, a dish of macaroni, and so forth. Although there are no people here, no sign of people, other than the fire and the hearth, burning brightly as if just lit, and the food still warm on the stove. Hunt is unnerved by it. By it and by the terrible withdrawal symptoms he is suffering from the loss of contact with the datasphere. I can imagine his pain. For a person born and raised into a world where information was always at hand, communication with anyone anywhere a given, and no distance more than a Farcaster step away, this sudden regression to life as our ancestors had known it would be like suddenly awakening blind and crippled. But after the rantings and rages of the first few hours of walking, Hunt finally settled down into a taciturn gloom.
"But the CEO needs me,"
he had shouted that first hour. "She needs the information I was bringing her," I said. "But there's nothing to be done about it."
"Where are we?"
demanded Hunt for the 10th time. I had already explained about this alternate old Earth, but I knew he meant something else now. Quarantine, I think, I said.
The Corps brought us here?
Demanded Hunt. I can only assume.
How do we get back?
I don't know. I presume that when they feel it safe to allow us out of quarantine, a Farcaster portal will appear. Hunt cursed softly.
Why quarantine me, Severn?
I shrugged. I assumed it was because he had heard what I said on Patchum, but I was not certain. I was certain of nothing. The road led through meadows, vineyards, winding over low hills and twisting through valleys, where glimpses of the sea were visible.
Where does this road go?
Hunt demanded just before we discovered the inn. All roads lead to Rome.
I'm serious, Severn.
So am I, M. Hunt. Hunt pried a loose stone from the highway and threw it far into the bushes. Somewhere a thrush called.
You've been here before?
Hunt's tone was one of accusation, as if I had pirated him away. Perhaps I had. No, I said. But Keats had, I almost added. My transplanted memories surged to the surface, almost overwhelming me with their sense of loss and looming mortality. So far from friends, so far from Fanny, his one eternal love.
You're sure you can't access the datasphere?
Asked Hunt. I'm positive, I answered. He did not ask about the megasphere, and I did not offer the information. I am terrified of entering the megasphere, of losing myself there. We found the inn just at sunset. It was nestled in a small valley, and smoke rose from the stone chimney. While eating, darkness pressing against the panes, our only light the flicker of the fire and two candles on a stone mantel, Hunt said,
"This place makes me half believe in ghosts."
"I do believe in ghosts," I said. Night. I awake coughing, feel wetness on my bare chest, hear Hunt fumbling with the candle, and in its light look down to see blood on my skin, spotting the bedclothes.
"My God,"
breathes Hunt, horrified.
"What is it? What's going on?"
"Hemorrhage," I manage after the next fit of coughing leaves me weaker and spotted with more blood. I start to rise, fall back on the pillow, and gesture toward the basin of water and towel on the nightstand.
"Damn, damn,"
mutters Hunt, searching for my comm log to get a med reading. There is no comm log. I had thrown away Hoyt's useless instrument while we were walking earlier in the day. Hunt removes his own comm log, adjusts the monitor, and wraps it around my wrist. The readings are meaningless to him, other than to signify urgency and the need for immediate medical care. Like most people of his generation, Hunt had never seen illness or death. That was a professional matter, handled out of sight of the populace. "Never mind," I whisper. The siege of coughing passed, but weakness lying on me like a blanket of stones. I gesture toward the towel again, and Hunt moistens it, washes the blood from my chest and arms, helps me sit in the single chair while he removes the spattered sheets and blankets.
"Do you know what's going on?"
he asks, real concern in his voice. "Yes," I attempt a smile. "Accuracy. Verisimilitude. Ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny."
"Makes sense,"
snaps Hunt, helping me back into the bed.
"What caused the hemorrhage? What can I do to help?"
"A glass of water, please." I sip it, feel the boiling in my chest and throat, but manage to avoid another round of coughing. My belly feels as if it's on fire.
"What's going on?"
Hunt asks again. I talk slowly, carefully, setting each word in place as if placing my feet on soil strewn with mines. The coughing does not return. "It's an illness called consumption," I say. "Tuberculosis. The final stages, judging from the severity of the hemorrhage." Hunt's basset hound face is white.
"Good God, Severn! I never heard of tuberculosis."
He raises his wrist as if to consult his comlog memory, but the wrist is bare. I return his instrument. Tuberculosis has been absent for centuries. Cured. But John Keats had it. Died of it. And this cybrid body belongs to Keats. Hunt stands as if ready to rush out the door seeking help.
Surely the Corps will allow us to return now. They can't keep you here on this empty world where there's no medical assistance.
I lay my head back in the soft pillows, feeling the feathers under the ticking. That may be precisely why I am being kept here. We'll see tomorrow when we arrive in Rome.
But you can't travel. We won't be going anywhere in the morning.
We'll see, I say, and close my eyes. We'll see. In the morning, a vettura, a small carriage, is waiting outside the inn. The horse is a large gray mare, and it rolls its eyes at us as we approach. The creature's breath rises in the chill morning air.
"Do you know what that is?" says Hunt.
"A horse." Hunt raises a hand toward the animal, as if it will pop and disappear like a soap bubble when he touches its flank. It does not. Hunt snatches his hand back as the mare's tail flicks.
"Horses are extinct," he says. "They've never been Arnied back into existence."
"This one looks real enough," I say, climbing into the carriage and sitting on the narrow bench there. Hunt gingerly takes his seat beside me, his long fingers twitching with anxiety.
"Who drives?" he says. "Where are the controls?"
There are no reins, and the coachman's seat is quite empty. "Let's see if the horse knows the way," I suggest, and at that instant we start moving at a leisurely pace, the springless carriage jolting over the stones and furrows of the rough road.
"This is some sort of joke, isn't it?"
asks Hunt, staring at the flawless blue sky and distant fields. I cough as lightly and briefly as possible into a handkerchief I have made from a towel borrowed from the inn.
"Possibly," I say.
"But then, what isn't?" Hunt ignores my sophistry, and we rumble on, jolting and bouncing toward whatever destination and destiny await.
"Where are Hunt and Severn?" asked Mena Gladstone.
"Sedeptra Akasi, the young black woman who was Gladstone's second most important aide, leaned closer so as not to interrupt the flow of the military briefing.
"Still no word, M-Executive."
"That's impossible. Severn had a tracer, and Lee stepped through to Pacham almost an hour ago. Where the hell are they?"
Akasi glanced toward the fax pad she had unfolded on the tabletop.
"Security can't find them. The transit police can't locate them. The Farcaster unit recorded only that they coded TC squared, here, stepped through, but did not arrive."
"That's impossible."
"Yes, M-Executive."
"I want to talk to Albedo or one of the other AI counselors as soon as this meeting is over."
"Yes."
Both women returned their attention to the briefing. The Government House Tactical Center had been joined to the Olympus Command Center War Room and to the largest Senate briefing room with 15-meter square, visually open portals, so that the three spaces created one cavernous and asymmetrical conference area. The War Room hollows seemed to rise into infinity on the display end of the space, and columns of data floated everywhere along the walls.
4 minutes until cislunar incursion," said Admiral Singh. "Their long-range weapons could have opened up on Heaven's Gate long before this," said General Morpurgo. "They seem to be showing some restraint."
"They didn't show much restraint toward our torch ships,"
said Garion Persoff of Diplomacy.
The group had been assembled an hour earlier, when the sortie of the hastily assembled fleet of a dozen hegemony torch ships had been summarily destroyed by the advancing swarm. Long-range sensors had relayed the briefest image of that swarm, a cluster of embers with comet-like fusion tails, before the torch ships and their remotes quit broadcasting. There had been many, many embers.
"Those were warships," said General Morpurgo. "We've been broadcasting for hours now that Heaven's Gate is an open planet. We can hope for restraint."
The holographic images of Heaven's Gate surrounded them. The quiet streets of Mudflat, airborne images of the coastline, orbital images of the gray-brown world with its constant cloud cover, cislunar images of the baroque dodecahedron of the singularity sphere, which tied together all forecasters, and space-aimed telescopic UV and X-ray images of the advancing swarm, much larger than specks or embers now, at less than 1 AU. Gladstone looked up at the fusion tails of ouster warships, the tumbling containment field shimmering massiveness of their asteroid farms and bubble worlds, their complex and oddly non-human zero-gravity city complexes, and she thought, what if I am wrong? The lives of billions rested on her belief that the ousters would not wantonly destroy hegemony worlds.
2 minutes until incursion, Singh said in his professional warrior's monotone.
Admiral, said Gladstone, is it absolutely necessary to destroy the singularity sphere as soon as the ousters have penetrated our cordon sanitaire? Couldn't we wait another few minutes to judge their intentions?
No, CEO, answered the Admiral promptly. The Farcaster link must be destroyed as soon as they are within quick assault range.
But if your remaining torch ships don't do it, Admiral, we still have the in-system links, the fatline relays, and the timed devices, don't we?
Yes, M-Executive, but we must assure that all forecaster capability is removed before the ousters overrun the system. There can be no compromising this already slim safety margin.
Gladstone nodded. She understood the need for absolute caution. If only there were more time.
15 seconds until incursion and singularity destruction, said Singh. 10. 7.
Suddenly, all of the torch ship and cislunar remote hollows glowed violet, red, and white. Gladstone leaned forward. Was that the singularity sphere going? The military men buzzed amongst themselves, calling up further data, switching images on the hollows and screens.
No, CEO, answered Morpurgo. The torch ships are under attack. What you're seeing is their defensive fields overloading.
There. A central image, possibly from a low-orbital relay ship, showed an enhanced image of the dodecahedronal singularity containment sphere, its 30,000 square meters of surface still intact, still glowing in the harsh light of Heaven's Gate's sun. Then, suddenly, the glow increased. The nearest face of the structure seemed to become incandescent and sag in upon itself, and less than 3 seconds later, the sphere expanded as the caged singularity there escaped and devoured itself, as well as everything within a 600-kilometer radius. At the same instant, most of the visual images and many of the data columns went blank.
All forecaster connections terminated, announced Singh. In-system data now relayed by fatline transmitters only.
There was a buzz of approval and relief from the military people. Something closer to a sigh and soft moan from the dozens of senators and political advisers present. The world of Heaven's Gate had just been amputated from the web. The first such loss of a hegemony world in more than 4 centuries. Gladstone turned to Sedeptra Akasi. What is time travel to Heaven's Gate from the web now? By Hawking Drive 7 months on board, said the aide without a pause to access. A little over 9 years time debt. Gladstone nodded. Heaven's Gate was now 9 years distant from the nearest web world.
There go our torch ships, intoned Singh.
The view had been from one of the orbital pickets, relayed through the jerky, false-color images of high-speed fatline squirts, being computer-processed in rapid progression. The images were visual mosaics, but they always made Gladstone think of the earliest silent films from the dawn of the media age. But this was no Charlie Chaplin comedy. 2, then 5, then 8 bursts of brilliant light blossomed against the starfield above the limb of the planet.
Transmissions from H.S. Nicky Weimart, H.S. Terrapin, H.S. Cornet, and H.S. Andrew Paul have ceased, reported Singh.
Barbry Dan Giddes raised a hand.
What about the other four ships, Admiral?
Only the four mentioned had FTL comm capability. The pickets confirmed that radio, maser, and wideband comm links from the other four Tort ships also have ceased. The visual data... Singh stopped and gestured toward the image relayed from the automatic picket ship. Eight expanding and fading circles of light, a starfield crawling with fusion tails and new lights. Suddenly even that image went blank.
All orbital sensors and fatline relays terminated, said General Morpurgo.
He gestured, and the blackness was replaced with images of the streets of Heaven's Gate, with the inevitable low-lying clouds. Aircraft added shots above the clouds, a sky gone crazy with moving stars.
All reports confirm total destruction of the Singularity Sphere, said Singh. Advance units of the swarm now entering high orbit around Heaven's Gate.
How many people are left there? Asked Gladstone.
She was leaning forward, her elbows on the table, her hands folded very tightly.
86,789, said Defense Minister Emoto.
That doesn't count the 12,000 Marines who were far cast in during the past 2 months, added General von Zeit.
Emoto nodded toward the general. Gladstone thanked them and returned her attention to the hollows. The data columns floating above and their extracts on the fax pads, comm logs, and table panels held the pertinent data. Numbers of swarm craft now in system, number and types of ships in orbit, projected braking orbits and time curves, energy analyses and comm band intercepts. But Gladstone and the others were watching the relatively uninformative and unchanging fat-lined images from the aircraft and surface cameras. Stars, cloud tops, streets, the view from atmospheric generating station heights out over the mudflat promenade where Gladstone herself had stood less than 12 hours earlier. It was night there. Giant horsetail ferns moved to silent breezes blowing in from the bay.
I think they'll negotiate, Senator Richaud was saying. First they'll present us with this fait accompli, 9 worlds overrun, then they'll negotiate and negotiate hard for a new balance of power. I mean, even if both of their invasion waves succeeded, that would be 25 worlds out of almost 200 in the web and protectorate.
Yes, said Head of Diplomacy Persoff.
But don't forget, Senator, that these include some of our most strategically important worlds. This one, for example. TC squared is only 235 hours behind Heaven's Gate on the ouster timetable.
Senator Richaud stared Persoff down.
I'm well aware of that, she said coldly. I'm merely saying that the ousters cannot have true conquest on their minds. That would be pure folly on their part. Nor will force allow the second wave to penetrate so deeply. Certainly this so-called invasion is a prelude to negotiation.
Perhaps, said Nordholm's Senator Rohnquist.
But such negotiation would necessarily depend upon...
Wait... said Gladstone.
The data columns now showed more than 100 ouster warcraft in orbit around Heaven's Gate. Ground forces there had been instructed not to fire unless fired upon, and no activity was visible in the 30-some views being fat-lined to the war room. Suddenly, however, the cloud cover above Mudflat City glowed, as if giant searchlights had been turned on. A dozen broad beams of coherent light stabbed down into the bay and the city, continuing the searchlight illusion, appearing to Gladstone as if giant white columns had been erected between the ground and the ceiling of clouds. That illusion ended abruptly, as a whirlwind of flame and destruction erupted at the base of each of these 100-meter-wide columns of light. The water of the bay boiled until huge geysers of steam occluded the nearer cameras. The view from the heights showed century-old stone buildings in the town erupting into flame, imploding as if a tornado were moving amongst them. The web-famous gardens and commons of the promenade erupted in flame, exploded in dirt and flying debris as if an invisible plow were moving across them. Horsetail ferns 2 centuries old bent as if before a hurricane wind burst into flame and were gone.
Lances from a Bowers-class tort ship,
Admiral Singh sent into the silence, or its ouster equivalent. The city was burning, exploding, being plowed into rubble by the light columns, and then being torn asunder again. There were no audio channels on these fat-lined images, but Gladstone imagined that she could hear screams. One by one, the ground cameras went black. The view from the atmospheric generating station heights disappeared in a white flash. Airborne cameras were already gone. The 20 or so other ground-based images began winking out, one in a terrible burst of crimson that left everyone in the room rubbing their eyes.
"Plasma explosion," said Van Zeit. "Low megaton range."
The view had been of a Force Marine air defense complex north of the Intercity Canal. Suddenly, all images ceased. Data flow ended. The room lights began to come up to compensate for a darkness so sudden that it took everyone's breath away.
"The primary fatline transmitter's gone," said General Morpurgo. "It was at the main force base near Highgate, buried under our strongest containment field, 50 meters of rock, and 10 meters of whiskered stalloy."
"Shaped nuclear charges?" asked Barbary Dangiddis.
"At least," said Morpurgo.
Senator Kolchev rose, his Lusian bulk emanating an almost ursine sense of strength.
"All right, this isn't some goddamned negotiating ploy. The ousters have just reduced the web world to ashes. This is all-out, give-no-mercy warfare. The survival of civilization is at stake. What do we do now?"
All eyes turned toward Mayna Gladstone. The consul dragged a semi-conscious Theo Lane from the wreckage of the skimmer and staggered 50 meters with the younger man's arm over his shoulder before collapsing on a stretch of grass beneath trees along the bank of the Hooghly River. The skimmer was not on fire, but it lay crumpled against the collapsed stone wall where it had finally skidded to a halt. Bits of metal and ceramic polymers lay strewn along the riverbank and abandoned avenue. The city was burning. Smoke obscured the view across the river, and this part of Jacktown, the old section, looked as if several pyres had been lighted where thick columns of black smoke rose toward the low cloud ceiling. Combat lasers and missile trails continued to streak through the haze, sometimes exploding against the assault dropships, parafoils, and suspension field bubbles, which continued to drop through the clouds like chaff blown from a recently harvested field.
"Theo, are you all right?"
The Governor General nodded and moved to push his glasses higher on his nose, stopping in confusion as he realized that his glasses were gone. Blood streaked Theo's forehead and arms.
"Hit my head,"
he said groggily. "We need to use your comm log," said the consul. "Get someone here to pick us up." Theo nodded, lifted his arm, and frowned at his wrist.
"Gone," he said. "Comlog's gone. Gotta look in the skimmer."
He tried to get to his feet. The consul pulled him back down. They were in the shelter of a few ornamental trees here, but the skimmer was exposed, and their landing had been no secret. The consul had glimpsed several armored troops moving down an adjacent street as the skimmer pancaked in for its crash landing. They might be SDF or ousters or even hegemony marines, but the consul imagined that they would be trigger-happy, whatever their loyalties. "Never mind that," he said. "We'll get to a phone. Call the consulate." He looked around, identified the section of warehouses and stone buildings where they had crashed. Upriver a few hundred meters, an old cathedral stood abandoned, its chapter house crumbling and overhanging the riverbank. "I know where we are," said the consul. "It's just a block or two to Cicero's. Come on." He lifted Theo's arm over his head and onto his shoulders, pulling the injured man to his feet.
"Cicero's, good," muttered Theo. "Could use a drink."
The rattle of flechette fire and an answering sizzle of energy weapons came from the street to their south. The consul took as much of Theo's weight as he could and half-walked, half-staggered along the narrow lane beside the river.
"Oh, damn,"
the consul whispered. Cicero's was burning. the old bar and inn, as old as Jacktown and much older than most of the capital, had lost three of its four sagging riverfront buildings to the flames, and only a determined bucket brigade of patrons was saving the last section.
"I see Stan," said the consul, pointing to the huge figure of Stan Lewesky standing near the head of the bucket brigade line.
"Here." The consul helped Theo to a sitting position under an elm tree along the walkway.
"How's your head?"
"Hurts."
"I'll be right back with help," said the consul and moved as quickly as he could down the narrow lane toward the men. Stan Lewesky stared at the consul as if he were a ghost. The big man's face was streaked with soot and tears, and his eyes were wide, almost uncomprehending. Ciceros had been in his family for six generations. It was raining softly now, and the fire seemed beaten. Men shouted up and down the line as a few timbers from the burned-out section sagged into the embers of the basement.
"By God, it's gone," said Lewesky. "You see? Grandfather Jiri's addition. It's gone."
The consul grabbed the huge man by his shoulders.
"Stan, we need help. Theo's over there, hurt. Our skimmer crashed. We need to get to the spaceport, to use your phone. It's an emergency, Stan."
Lewesky shook his head.
"Phone's gone. Comlog bands are jammed. Goddamn war is on."
He pointed toward the burned sections of the old inn.
"They're gone, by damn. Gone."
The consul made a fist, furious in the grip of sheer frustration. Other men milled around, but the consul recognized none of them. There were no force or SDF authorities in sight. Suddenly, a voice behind him said,
"I can help. I have a skimmer."
The consul whirled to see a man in his late 50s or early 60s, soot and sweat covering his handsome face and streaking his wavy hair.
"Great," said the consul. "I'd appreciate it."
He paused. "Do I know you?"
"Dr. Emilio Arendez,"
said the man, already moving toward the parkway where Theo rested.
"Arendez,"
repeated the consul, hurrying to keep up. The name echoed strangely. Someone he knew? Someone he should know?
"My God, Arendez," he said. "You were the friend of Rachel Weintraub when she came here decades ago."
"Her university advisor, actually," said Arendez. "I know you. You went on the pilgrimage with Saul."
They stopped where Theo was sitting, still holding his head in his hands.
"My skimmer's over there," said Arendez.
The consul could see a small, two-person Vicken Zephyr parked under the trees.
"Great. We'll get Theo to the hospital, and then I need to get to the spaceport immediately."
"The hospital's overcrowded to the point of insanity," said Arendez. "If you're trying to get to your ship, I suggest you take the Governor General there and use the ship surgery."
The consul paused. "How did you know I have a ship there?" Arendez dilated the doors and helped Theo onto the narrow bench behind the front contour seats.
"I know all about you and the other pilgrims, M. Consul. I've been trying to get permission to go to the Valley of the Time Tombs for months. You can't believe my frustration when I learned that your pilgrim's barge left secretly with Saul aboard."
Arendez took a deep breath and asked a question which he obviously had been afraid to ask before.
"Is Rachel still alive?"
"He was her lover when she was a grown woman," thought the consul.
"I don't know," he said.
"I'm trying to get back in time to help her if I can."
Emilio Arendez nodded and settled into the driver's seat, gesturing for the consul to get in.
"We'll try to get to the spaceport. It won't be easy with the fighting around there."
The consul sat back, feeling his bruises, cuts, and exhaustion as the seat folded around him.
"We need to get Theo, the Governor General, to the consulate or government house or whatever they call it now."
Arendez shook his head and powered up the repellers.
"Uh-uh. The consulate's gone, hit by a wayward missile, according to the emergency news channel. All the hegemony officials went out to the spaceport for evacuation before your friend even went hunting for you."
The consul looked at the semi-conscious Theo Lane.
"Let's go," he said softly to Arendez.
The skimmer came under small arms fire as they crossed the river, but flechettes merely rattled on the hull, and the single energy beam fire sliced beneath them, sending a spout of steam 10 meters high. Arendez drove like a crazy person, weaving, bobbing, pitching, yawing, and occasionally slewing the skimmer around on its axis like a plate sliding atop a sea of marbles. The consul's seat restraints closed around him, but he still felt his gorge threaten to rise. Behind them, Theo's head moved loosely back and forth on the rear bench as he surrendered to unconsciousness.
"The downtown's a mess," Arendez shouted over repeller roar. "I'll follow the old viaduct to the spaceport highway and then cut across country, staying low."
They pirouetted around a burning structure, which the consul belatedly recognized as his old apartment building.
"Is the spaceport highway open?"
Arendez shook his head.
"Never make it. Paratroopers have been dropping around it for the last 30 minutes.
"Are the ousters trying to destroy the city?"
"Uh-uh. They could have done that from orbit without all this fuss. They seem to be investing the capital. Most of their dropships and paratroopers land at least 10 clicks out."
"Is it RSDF who's fighting back?"
Arendez laughed, showing white teeth against tanned skin.
"They're halfway to Endymion in Port Romance by now, though reports 10 minutes ago, before the comm lines were jammed, say that those cities are also under attack. No, the little resistance you see is from a few dozen Force Marines left behind to guard the city and the spaceport."
"So the ousters haven't destroyed or captured the spaceport?"
"Not yet. At least not as of a few minutes ago. We'll soon see. Hang on."
The 10-kilometer ride to the spaceport, via the VIP highway or the skylanes above it, usually took a few minutes. But Arendez's roundabout, up-and-down approach over the hills, through the valleys and between the trees, added time and excitement to the trip. The consul turned his head to watch hillsides and the slums of burning refugee camps flash by to his right. Men and women crouched against boulders and under low trees, covering their heads as the skimmer rushed past. Once the consul saw a squad of Force Marines dug in on a hilltop. But their attention was focused on a hill to the north, from which there came a panoply of laser lance fire. Arendez saw the Marines at the same instant and jinked the skimmer hard left, dropping it into a narrow ravine scant seconds before the treetops on the ridge above were sliced off as if by invisible shears. Finally, they roared up and over a final ridgeline, and the western gates and fences of the spaceport became visible ahead of them. The perimeter was ablaze with the blue and violet glows of containment and interdiction fields, and they were still a click away when a visible tight-beam laser flicked out, found them, and a voice over the radio said,
"Unidentified skimmer, land immediately or be destroyed."
Arendez landed. The tree line 10 meters away seemed to shimmer, and suddenly they were surrounded by wraiths in activated chameleon polymers. Arendez had opened the cockpit blisters, and now assault rifles were aimed at him and the consul.
"Step away from the machine," said a disembodied voice behind the camouflage shimmer.
"We have the Governor General," called the consul. "We have to get in."
"The hell you say,"
snapped a voice with a definite web accent.
"Out!"
The consul and Arendez hastily released their seat restraints and had started to climb out when a voice from the back seat snapped,
"Lieutenant Mueller, is that you?"
Yes, sir."
"Do you recognize me, Lieutenant?"
The camouflage shimmer depolarized, and a young Marine in full battle armor stood not a meter from the skimmer. His face was nothing more than a black visor, but the voice sounded young.
"Yes, sir, Governor. Sorry, I didn't recognize you without your glasses. You've been hurt, sir."
"I know I've been hurt, Lieutenant. That is why these gentlemen have escorted me here. Don't you recognize the former Hegemony Consul for Hyperion?"
"Sorry, sir," said Lieutenant Mueller, waving his men back into the tree line. "The base is sealed."
"Of course the base is sealed,"
Theo said through gritted teeth.
"I countersigned those orders, but I also authorized evacuation of all essential Hegemony personnel. You did allow those skimmers through, did you not, Lieutenant Mueller?"
An armored hand rose, as if to scratch the helmeted and visored head.
Yes, sir, affirmative, but that was an hour ago, sir. The evacuation dropships are gone and—"
"For God's sake, Mueller, get on your tactical channel and get authorization from Colonel Gerasimov to let us through."
"The colonel's dead, sir. There was a dropship assault on the east perimeter and...
Captain Llewellyn, then, said Theo.
He swayed and then steadied himself against the back of the consul's seat. His face was very white under the blood.
Tactical channels are down, sir. The ousters are jamming on wideband with...
Lieutenant, snapped Theo in a tone the consul had never heard his young friend use.
You visually identified me and scanned my implant ID. Now either admit us to the field or shoot us.
The armored marine glanced back toward the tree line, as if considering whether to order his men to open fire.
The dropships are all gone, sir. Nothing else is coming down.
Theo nodded. Blood had dried and caked on his forehead, but now a fresh trickle started from his scalp line.
The impounded ship is still in Blast Pit 9, isn't it?
Yes, sir, answered Mueller, snapping to attention at last.
But it's a civilian ship and could never make space with all the ouster...
Theo waved the officer into silence and gestured for Arendez to drive toward the perimeter. The consul glanced ahead toward the deadlines, interdiction fields, containment fields, and probable pressure mines that the skimmer would encounter in 10 seconds. He saw the marine lieutenant wave and an opening irised in the violet and blue energy fields ahead. No one fired. In half a minute they were crossing the hard pan of the spaceport itself. Something large was burning on the northern perimeter. To their left, a huddle of forced trailers and command modules had been slagged to a pool of bubbling plastic. There had been people in there, thought the consul, and once again had to fight to keep his gorge from rising. Blast Pit 7 had been destroyed, its circular walls of reinforced 10-centimeter carbon-carbon blown outward and apart as if they had been made of cardboard. Blast Pit 8 was burning with that white-hot incandescence which suggested plasma grenades. Blast Pit 9 was intact, with the bow of the consul's ship just visible above the pit wall through the shimmer of a Class 3 containment field.
"The interdiction's been lifted," said the consul.
Theo lay back on the cushioned bench. His voice was thick.
"Yeah. Gladstone authorized the dropping of the restraining dome field. That's just the usual protective field. You can override it with a command."
Arendez dropped the skimmer to tarmac just as warning lights went red and synthesized voices began describing malfunctions. They helped Theo out and paused near the rear of the small skimmer, where a line of flechettes had stitched a ragged row through the engine cowling and repeller housing. Part of the hood had melted from overload. Emilio Arendez patted the machine once, and both men turned to help Theo through the blast pit door and up the docking umbilical.
"My God," said Dr. Emilio Arendez, "this is beautiful. I've never been in a private interstellar spacecraft before." "There are only a few dozen in existence," said the consul, setting the osmosis mask in place over Theo's mouth and nose and gently lowering the redhead into the surgery's tank of emergency care nutrient. "Small as it is, the ship costs several hundred million marks. It's not cost-effective for corporations and outback planetary governments to use their military craft on those rare occasions when they need to travel between the stars." The consul sealed the tank and conversed briefly with the diagnostics program. "He'll be all right," he said at last to Arendez, and returned to the hollow pit. Emilio Arendez stood near the antique Steinway, gently running his hand over the glossy finish of the grand piano. He glanced out through the transparent section of hull above the stowed balcony platform and said,
"I see fires near the main gate. We'd better get out of here."
"That's what I'm doing," said the consul, gesturing Arendez toward the circular couch lining the projection pit.
The archaeologist dropped into the deep cushions and glanced around.
"Aren't there, controls?"
The consul smiled.
"A bridge? Cockpit instruments? Maybe a wheel I can steer with?"
"Ship?"
"Yes,"
came the soft voice from nowhere. "Are we cleared for takeoff?"
"Yes."
"Is that containment field removed?"
"It was our field. I've withdrawn it."
"Okay, let's get the hell out of here. I don't have to tell you that we're in the middle of a shooting war, do I?"
"No. I've been monitoring all developments.
the last four spacecraft are in the process of leaving the Hyperion system. These Marines are stranded and—
Save the tactical analyses for later, ship, said the consul. Set our course for the Valley of the Time Tombs and get us out of here.
Yes, sir, said the ship. I was just pointing out that the forces defending this spaceport have little chance of holding out for more than an hour or so.
Noted, said the consul. Now take off.
I'm required to share this Fatline transmission first. The squirt arrived at 16:22:38:14, Webb standard, this afternoon.
Whoa, hold it, cried the consul, freezing the holo transmission in mid-construction.
Half of Mayna Gladstone's face hung above them.
You're required to show this before we leave? Whose commands do you respond to, ship?
CEO Gladstone, sir. The chief executive empowered a priority override on all ship's functions 5 days ago. This Fatline squirt is the last requirement before.
So that's why you didn't respond to my remote commands, murmured the consul.
Yes, said the ship in conversational tones. I was about to say that the showing of this transmission is the last requirement prior to returning command to you.
And then you'll do what I say?
Yes.
Take us where I'll tell you to?
Yes.
No hidden overrides?
None that I know of.
Play the squirt, said the consul.
The Lincoln-esque countenance of CEO Mayna Gladstone floated in the center of the projection pit, with the telltale twitches and breakups endemic to Fatline transmissions.
I am pleased that you survived the visit to the Time Tombs, she said to the consul. By now you must know that I am asking you to negotiate with the ousters before you return to the valley.
The consul folded his arms and glared at Gladstone's image. Outside the sun was setting. He had only a few minutes before Rachel Weintraub reached her birth hour and minute and simply ceased to exist.
I understand your urgency to return and help your friends, said Gladstone. But you can do nothing to help the child at this moment. Experts in the web assure us that neither cryogenic sleep or fugue could arrest the Merlin sickness.
Saul knows this.
Across the projection pit, Dr. Arendez said,
It's true. They experimented for years. She would die in fugue state.
You can help the billions of people in the web whom you believe you have betrayed, Gladstone was saying.
The consul leaned forward and rested his elbows on his knees and his chin on his fists. His heart was pounding very loudly in his ears.
I knew that you would open the Time Tombs, Gladstone said, her sad brown eyes seeming to stare directly at the consul. Core predictors showed that your loyalty to Maui Covenant and to the memory of your grandparents' rebellion would override all other factors. It was time for the tombs to be opened, and only you could activate the ouster device before the ousters themselves decided to.
I've heard enough of this, said the consul and stood, turning his back on the projection. Cancel message, he said to the ship, knowing that it would not obey.
Melio Arendez walked through the projection and gripped the consul's arm tightly.
Hear her out, please.
The consul shook his head but stayed in the pit, arms folded.
Now the worst has happened, said Gladstone. The ousters are invading the web. Heaven's Gate is being destroyed. God's Grove has less than an hour before the invasion sweeps over it. It is imperative that you meet with the ousters in Hyperion system and negotiate. Use your diplomatic skills to open a dialogue with them. The ousters will not respond to our Fatline or radio messages, but we have alerted them to your coming. I think they will still trust you.
The consul moaned and walked over to the piano, pounding his fist against its lid.
We have minutes, not hours, consul, said Gladstone. I will ask you to go first to the ousters in Hyperion system, and then attempt to return to the Valley of the Time Tombs, if you must. You know better than I the results of warfare. Millions will die needlessly if we cannot find a secure channel through which to communicate with the ousters. It is your decision, but please consider the ramifications if we fail in this last attempt to find the truth and preserve the peace. I will contact you via Fatline once you